I have often been asked what my plans are. My reply is that I have no scheme. My country, like every other, will evolve its own constitution. It will pass through its experimental phase and settle down into something quite different from what you or I expect. In 1930, when Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore spoke with H.G. Wells, independence for India was 17 years in the future. In the years since, how has India settled down, and how is it affecting our lives in the United States? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Sixty years after independence, how is the world's second most populous country, with more than a billion people, holding together? And what impact is it having on the stability of nations and the world's economy? Our guest is Asima Sinha, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for inviting me.
I saw a quotation from E.M. Forster's Passage to India where he writes, "Nothing embraces the whole of India, nothing, nothing." Kind of, I guess, acknowledging the gigantic nature of India, both in terms of the population, but just the diversity of languages and religions within India. Before we get into an hour on India, which is by definition sort of impossible to do, can you say something about just the scope that we're talking about when you talk about Indian history, politics, culture?
India is, of course, famously very diverse and complex. And I think what is interesting is that its diversity is quite multidimensional, both religious, linguistic, in terms of regions, in terms of other ethnic identities, and also politically. While it has first past the post system, it also has multiple parties. And so it's extremely complex. Each of those diversities have some chance of being represented. So almost on every aspect of economic, social, political, and cultural life, the diversity is quite huge. In my opinion, to some extent, it's also a strength. And because it's precisely because there are so many diversities which cross-cut each other that you actually don't have those diversities coming together and creating problems, although there are lots of problems too. So I think that's what I would say, that the scope is extremely huge of the diversity. It's multiple and multiple dimensions of diversities which exist.
And what do you think are the most common misconceptions that most Americans have about India?
Well, I guess the most common misconceptions are that only one aspect, exhausts India. So, for example, India is extremely poor, but the other side of it, it's growing at the rate of 9% per annum for the last 3 years at least. And so the trick is to put together these contradictory things. The other myth is that, of course, Indians are very different from Americans or the rest of the world. They have a different mind and the way they think. And they are different, but there are lots of Indians who are actually very similar to Americans. And partly because of the English language, they are able to live in different worlds very easily. And so you'll find as many people in India who at least think like what you would come across in America, usually, depending on which part of America. America is also very diverse. So I think that aspect is also an important kind of myth, that Indians are different from everybody else. And they may not be there. A lot of similarities in the way they think.
Since it's bounded by oceans and tall mountains, you might think that India would have a homogeneous population.
Yes, that is true. But partly because India has been invaded from about 9th, 10th century. It has been invaded regularly by different rulers. There are kind of layers of cultures and civilizations which have kind of come into India and made India its own. And of course, and shaped its institutions, but the institutions in India have also shaped the rulers themselves. So yes, there are lots of majorities, and Hindu majority is, of course, the most dominant one. And given recent developments, it is trying to claim itself a majority status. Although it's interesting to know that that Hinduism as a religion did not exist before the 19th century. As though there was no word which kind of defined Hinduism as one religion. Hindu religion is very famously divided. There are lots of regional sects and regional practices, religious practices. And it's only in the recent past that there is, you know, people think or think that there is one Hindu religion. It's not existed. So, you know, the attempt to imagine a majority is itself a political project, which kind of is acquired political context and political overtones in the recent times.
How far back does India go as a concept if we have all of these groups?
Well, some people would argue that actually does go back to 3,300 BC, but not in its present form. And that was the time when the Indus Valley civilization was populated on the banks of the river Indus. But it was, you know, in the north and in the west of India. The current boundaries of India have only taken shape in 1947. There was some landmass which has existed and it has had some continuity. But the exact boundaries, its shape, its political representation has changed quite dramatically over different periods. So that while one can talk up for continuous kind of history, it has a lot of ruptures and interesting variations in how it is defined as a, you know, as a overall structure.
And it seems as if it's a part of the sort of world history that often gets left out of American textbooks, that we go back and forth between American history and then European history. We throw in ancient Greece and Rome and maybe some ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
But Indian history, yeah, I think, is not well known in the same way that other cultures are. How much would you say ancient history of India or some of the traditions before the 1947 partition, how does that affect India today? I mean, how important is history?
Well, that's a fascinating question. It's extremely important in some ways. It's extremely important because people have very long memories in India. It's important for the culture, but it's not a homogeneous in the sense that it's not like one version of history. There are lots of people have different or different communities have different versions of their history. And I think each they bring that forward and carry that with them. So history is important, but different communities have different histories. And then so there is a lot of conflict about those different histories. And it can both be a burden as well as an opportunity because it allows at one level it is a burden because if people remember histories of violence or of conflict from earlier times, that can create problems. But it also gives learning resources to the people. So, for example, the responses to India had a short period of emergency, a non-democratic period between 1975 and 1977. But how the government responded during that time provides learning memories to the politicians today who know that they should never do what they did then. And so the continuity also provides some learning resources. So it's both a problem, the fact that India has a long history, but it's not one history. It's histories, and different communities and religions have very different histories, and each one of them have to be kind of understood. And I don't think it unites into one, you know, seamless whole, as it were. It does stay separate.
Well, what about in Indian schools in terms of textbooks? I'm always fascinated
yes.
by how are children taught the history of their country? How are textbooks constantly being rewritten and revised? And right now in sort of standard schools across India, is there a standard history of the country going back thousands of years that is taught?
Well, it's an interesting question because recently some political parties have argued that we must change the way the school textbooks are written. And the school textbooks, I think, kind of bring together a conventional understanding of India as a cultural syncretic civilization in which kind of tolerates every aspect and tolerates different religions. But yet, for example, some people have argued that there should be some mention of the fact that Mughal rulers came into India and they did bad things in India. But other people argue that, you know, since India has had this very tolerant culture, that we should talk about different histories the way I was suggesting earlier. So it has become politically contentious. And so there has been an attempt to rewrite school textbooks in the last 5 to 7 years. And in fact, currently the administration which deals with the writing of textbooks, the NCRT, that has rewritten some textbooks in the 10th and 12th. And they have tried to challenge this view that there is only one history and then that there are different kinds of history. So experiences of regional communities in the South, you know, there is some attempt to kind of involve that or insert that.
And say that what was maybe good from one standpoint or the standpoint of one group was not so good
sure.
for another. I mean, much as history would be taught here yeah. for quite a while now, I think, saying the American Indians really did not enjoy, for the most part, the experience of,
right.
of the European sure. Settlement. Are there values or concepts that are particularly Indian?
One could argue that acceptance or toleration of unexpected things or unpredictable things is certainly, because there are, it's a poor country in which a lot of things, unexpected things happen, as your quote started with, you know, that is certainly, most people expect the unexpected. So I think that is certainly one of the, you know, qualities, ability to kind of survive in almost any context. But I think that's true for almost every, you know, anybody, but it's certainly true in India, you know, strongly true in India, I would say.
So I almost get the sense that there's a survival with a certain amount of humor involved if you're expecting the unexpected.
Yes, right, right.
And yeah. When you have, 1.2 billion people, very nearly the same population of China.
Yeah. It's supposed to overtake China in 2030. So India will become the most populous country. And that's the projection, which is not necessarily a good thing.
I was wondering about that.
It's actually a problem, because that means that India has not been able to control its fertility rate as well as China has managed, although China has managed with a lot of other problems.
Well, let me ask you back to the topic of history, just to respond to those comments by Karl Marx in 1853, writing about India. Such a country and such a society, were they not the predestined prey of conquest, India could not escape the fate of being conquered, and the whole of her past history, if it be anything, is the history of successive conquests she has undergone. Indian society has no history at all, at least no known history. What we call its history is but the history of the successive intruders who founded their empires on the passive basis of that unresisting and unchanging society. The question, therefore, is not whether the English had a right to conquer India, but whether we are to prefer India conquered by the Turk, by the Persian, by the Russian, to India conquered by the Briton.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a comment.
Yes.
Passive? How passive were Indians?
Well, I guess it depends on what, if you think of there is something original, you know, the original inhabitants of India, and that itself has been contentious. The people who were there during the Indus Valley Civilization, one could consider them to be the original inhabitants. But then there were lots of people who were living in the south of India, the Dravidians, and they considered themselves to be that they were living there, you know, around the same time or a little later. And they were not known because history books were not, or, you know, in India one had oral history and not written history. So it's true that Indians were, I guess, passive in the sense, but there is no the Indian, as it were. You know, all of these people, in fact, came in and became Indian. That's what I would say. So the Mughal rulers came and they lived there for centuries. Before that, rulers came. The British came and, you know, then they lived and kind of there for 200 years.
They're known for going native,
yeah,
the British.
Right. So I think that it's certainly true that it looks like as if India has been acted upon rather than doing the acting, or Indians at least. But everything has been kind of reshaped by, for example, the language, Urdu language, was considered to be, was actually defined as a Hindi language because it was spoken within India. So I don't think that there is any pure Indian response, as it were. It has been shaped by each of the, there are lots and lots of layers to what is India in terms of the people who came in, and as well as the people who existed there and the way they shaped the rulers.
And before Gandhi comes along and really helps to lead the just heroic resistance and overthrow and all the rest of it, what would you say the effect of having it be England as the colonial power as opposed to France or Belgium or some of the other interfering nations that went around deciding they had empires everywhere?
Sure.
What difference has it made in, besides obviously that English has become the national language in a sense, what difference has it made politically and culturally that it was England?
That's again a very, very important or interesting kind of historical question. I think the one difference that it has made is that the progress of democracy in India has been very incremental, and Britain introduced very limited but democratic institutions. And of course, they were trying to curtail the amount of democracy they would give to Indians. But nonetheless, it was more than what French colonizers gave to their French colonies. And the manner in which it proceeded, which is progressively some reforms were introduced, democratic reforms or limited franchise were introduced to Indians, meant that the experience of democracy is quite long-standing. It goes back, in fact, it goes back to around 1909 or so, when the first democratic reforms were introduced by Britain. So the experience of democracy is incremental. It's slow-moving. It's like long-standing, and it's one step forward and two steps backward kind of experience. But it allows the country to manage its diversity and include different sections. So that was, I think, one good thing. The other thing was actually Western education. Apart from English, it was also the Western education which created a middle class. And partly because the British colonizers were very few compared to actually French colonizers and Dutch, you know, they actually send many more of metropolitan people. Britain essentially ruled through indirect rule. So it used Indians to rule Indians. And that meant that it created a hinge kind of a class of people who were navigating British Empire with the Indians. It, of course, created an elite. So it created class differences, which were overlaid with cultural differences because the people who spoke English also were powerful, but it also meant that a middle class was created, which was then able to, once it becomes politically conscious, it starts to criticize the British. And so India's national movement is much deeper, partly because of this kind of phenomena. Also, partly because British colony or colonization in India was very long-term and they really wanted a lot of economic benefits. They also introduced infrastructure of much, you know, for example, in Africa, even Britain in Africa was of a very short duration and did not introduce railways or other infrastructural facilities. They wanted to exploit India and so therefore they introduced railways so that they could actually extract all the raw materials and other things. The net result was that India did have a very well-ramified infrastructure. So these were some of the positives. I mean, there were lots of negatives, but these were some of the positives, which were not there in French colonies and other colonies, you know, Dutch colonies or German colonies.
How did the British actually go about seizing India? This will be our last question having to do with conquest, I think. But since the British managed to stay and have such an impact, how did they go about this?
Well, that's interesting. Initially, in 1600, the East India Company was a trading or a commercial company which wanted to trade with the world, was formed. And this the East India Company was that it would trade with India. And that time it was just a commercial company. And it started to trade with basically buy Indian goods, essentially cloth and muslin cloth, spices and other Indian goods, which were very popular in Europe. And from 1600 till about 1610, it actually started trading with India. And with Indian, you know, rulers, and they would just go there and or Indian just commercial people, they would just buy the stuff. And in about 1757, it used the powers of the British state, which had then become like Britain had become a naval power. So it used the powers to fight a war with an Indian ruler and acquired the right to collect revenue in the eastern part of India. So that was the first political entry into India by a commercial company supported by the British state. From 1757 to 1857, this East India Company ruled in the sense that it had the right to collect revenue and it had some kind of administration. But in 1857, there was a mutiny because within the army, the British army, which was essentially populated by Indians, they rebelled. And it was so partly a result of the mismanagement of the East India Company. So at that time, the British Crown or the British Parliament took over India. And so 1857, one could argue, is a formal taking over of India. But most history books consider 1757 to be a start of formal British colonialism or British conquest because that time political and economic conquest kind of came together, as it were.
And this would also include what we call Pakistan today?
Yes, the whole of British India, yes. And although, you know, Pakistan or the areas which became Pakistan were populated or took over, they were taken over at different stages. So in 1757, Eastern India, and then progressively, like different parts of India were taken over. It was not taken over in one go. It was different wars, and each kingdom was taken over, or there was treaties with different kingdoms. By 1857, you can say that all of British India, which includes parts of what became Pakistan, Ceylon, I think Ceylon was 1888 or so. It became part of British India. Burma.
Chunk of Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, Afghanistan was not part of British India, but Britain had control over Afghanistan. But it was not considered part of the British Indian Empire. But they kind of had it was a British protectorate from 1880 onwards.
They were busy over there.
Yes.
More on the history of India when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Asima Sinha, and we're talking about the world's second most populous country, probably soon to become the most populous country in the world. That would be India, a country that for a long time was a British colony. What effect did the British have on the caste system in India, and how did that whole thing work when the British arrived?
That's a very difficult question. Well, there is one myth, by the way, sorry to go back to your old question, which is that India's caste system is a rigid structure which is hierarchical. It's not rigid, although it is hierarchical. And so the one impact of British Empire colonialism was that actually they wanted to understand India in simple terms. And so they thought of or they began to conceptualize India as embodied in its caste system. And it is true that caste is dominant and has been dominant, but it's also true that it has radically transformed itself even while the British were there. French writer Guy Dumont categorized India into these four categories of castes, and five if you consider the untouchables, but they are not part of the caste system. But the actual truth is that each of those caste categories have hundreds of what are called jatis. And I think one impact of British Empire was actually to codify a very complex system into a simplified system so that it would make sense to the Westerners. And while that is important, or, you know, it's important to kind of translate cultures and the caste system, it also made it seem like extremely rigid and extremely immutable and similar across all of India. And I think what I should say is that the caste system creates problem for the lowest hierarchy, so that untouchables and what were called Dalits or scheduled castes, as they are called in India. And it certainly has some relevance or resonance for the upper caste, the Brahmins, although that has changed in post-independent history. But the caste system's description of the medium orders is extremely, you know, there's almost no generalizations which can be made about the medium orders. But caste system is actually, you know, like race in the United States. It has some power. It has much more power in the rural areas, but it varies extremely in extreme terms from region to region and province to province. In some parts, Brahmins are very powerful. In some parts, they are completely powerless, and backward caste movements have removed them from power. So I think the one impact was that everybody began to understand India to be a caste society.
One of the things that stayed in my mind from the two trips I made to India as a child was, in fact, the untouchables,
yes.
I think. Could you say something about the background of that and, you know, how that developed? Because right. It is something that's kind of hard to get around in terms of just
sure.
what right. that means on a human level.
Right. Well, one would not like to be born untouchable. I guess one could say that. It combines social, cultural, and economic deprivation. So what it means is basically that if you're born in the untouchable caste, you would do certain kinds of occupations and it would affect almost every life's chance that you would get. Having said that, and certainly in those areas where you are known to be, or if you are known to be of the untouchable caste, then you might be segregated. So you would live in certain parts of the village. Everybody would know who you are and you would not have access to temples or water areas or common resource areas in that area. So it does have very significant impact. In parts of India like Bihar, people are killed based on the basis of their caste, especially if they're untouchables. Women are raped because they are members of a certain caste. You know, that is one way for dominant caste to kind of dominate them and to ensure to show their power. So in some parts of the country, it has very profound impact. The other side of the coin is that in the post-independent period, partly because of this history of deprivation and extreme exploitation, Dalits and untouchables have actually started to mobilize themselves politically. And so there are, for example, currently there is a political party, which is Bahujan Samaj Party, BSP, which claims itself to be the party of the untouchable or the Dalits. And it has won power recently. In fact, it's won power in India's largest state, which is the state of Uttar Pradesh. And in other parts of the country also, the BSP or Dalits are mobilizing and they're using democracy because that's the one mechanism they do have to change their status, or at least their social status. Their economic status, interestingly, has not changed much. They continue to earn the least. But their social status and their political status has changed to some extent, partly mobilized by strong Dalit movements in many parts of the country.
Is the untouchable caste the largest? And therefore, democracy would be to their advantage if they have strength in numbers? Or?
They are about 11% of the population, 11 to 12%. So they're not the largest, but they are quite significant.
And
yes.
Who decided they were untouchable? In other words, how far back in history do you have to go to sort of figure out who made that judgment call?
Well, I guess it is based on occupations. It was written in the ritual texts. There are certain occupations, like, for example, if you clean a house, or you know, if you are a person who cleans houses, or you are engaged with leather. So there are some things, or some things, which are considered to be impure by Hindu religion. That's the source of the stratification. So the conventional understanding is that if you are doing certain kinds of occupation, which is dealing with leather, engaging in cleaning occupations, or you are then considered to be untouchable. Sometimes even artisans who make pottery are considered to be untouchables. So it was supposedly written in the Hindu texts that people doing certain kinds of occupations would have certain kinds of social status. And the untouchables are outside the Hindu caste system in the sense that you can't touch them. So if you touch them, anybody who touches them becomes impure because they are themselves impure because they are doing impure occupations.
But they're necessary at the same
yes,
time.
Yes, absolutely. They are completely necessary at the same time. And in fact, of course, there are stories of how, I mean, they're completely necessary to the economy in every village because they are doing very essential occupations.
Is there a way that you could, all else being equal, identify an untouchable from anyone else? I mean, you know, their context notwithstanding.
Certainly, sometimes names do signify, not always, but last names can signify to some people, I mean, to the people who have some knowledge about that who is untouchable. Although it's very difficult, you know, people have changed their names. So there is a phenomena of people changing their names and even the caste designations to get away from some of the problems. And also the second phenomena of people actually changing their names to become of certain castes, because then they get state benefits. Because it is, the Indian Constitution said we should do away with untouchability. But it also gave reservations to different sections, and especially untouchables, in government jobs and public sector jobs.
Excluded them from those jobs, you're saying?
No, included. They said that, like, for example, in educational institutions, you know, 27% of all educational seats have to be reserved for.
Oh,
so
it was
it's
a
more
quota
like a quota.
System.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
It's like a quota.
Now,
so that meant that many people would like to. But it is, to answer your question, in some contexts, you can find out from the names, although it's easier to find out whether you're from which region of the country rather than the caste. But in some names, it's clear what your caste is.
And are people aware, are Indians aware of what their caste is? All Indians know what caste they belong to?
I guess they do, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in urban situation, in urban context, it doesn't have an actual, operationalization. I mean, it's like saying, you know, it's like saying to hear, are you aware you're white or something? I think people are aware, yes.
So it's, the racism would be equivalent here to the caste prejudice there.
Yes, it is.
Can you say something about the position of women now in India, and also perhaps when you were first born in India, how have you seen it change, or how has history played a role also in
sure.
women in Indian society?
Sure. Well, the position of women, it's a complex kind of issue. Women... And here actually class comes in quite strongly, which is that some sections of women in India do very well and they are educated. And so they are given equal access to education. Like, for example, in my family, I was given equal opportunities in terms of education. And so in the middle class families, women are generally considered to be equal in terms of at least job and educational opportunities. But yet, patriarchal norms do operate. I mean, I think let me give you an example, which is that in India, the issue of the sexual division of labor in the home, which is that who does the home or housework, is not such a germane issue. Why? Because there are lots of servants to do the work. So women actually never tell their husbands or partners or whatever that you should share my household labor because they have other people to help them. So it's interesting in that men don't do housework generally. I mean, these are very broad generalizations, but generally men don't do work because there are other women who are working in the household. So this kind of typifies or shows that upper class women have lots of access to opportunities, but women generally suffer from lots of problems. I mean, one has the position of women, one has to divide in terms of, these economic and educational aspects versus issues about violence against women. It's certainly true that there is lots of norms about both about protecting women. So women are held in high esteem, but they are also subject to violence, although not as much as the U.S., but they are subject to violence, especially things like dowry murders.
Yes, and, we hear about those. Yeah.
When I was in India quite some time ago, one of the things that occurred, and this was in the home of a male professor in India, was that his wife would walk behind him a few paces when they went down the road. And then when dinner was served, the men would eat.
Yes.
And then the women would eat later and they would eat the leftovers. And they weren't quite sure what to do with Western women visiting. You know, the wife of an American professor was a kind of an awkward in-between step. Can you explain about why the walking behind the man tradition was there and whether that still exists?
It refers to the fact that men, you know, they know where they are going and they are the ones deciding where they have to go, kind of thing. And it reflects or shows that the woman is showing some kind of respect or she doesn't know where she's going. Also, it reflects the fact that in public places, the man is supposed to protect her because it is a very dense country. So if the man walks forward, then he can, you know, pave the way, as it were. So I think combination of all of those things, yeah, which is that the man is the breadwinner and decides where they're going. And in terms of eating habits, yes, many households, although it has changed quite radically in urban areas, but in the rural areas and in many parts, in fact, for example, in Bengal, it's certainly true that women eat last. So they first will serve and then they would eat. It, of course, you know, one way of looking at it is that it actually creates communities of women in which they're eating together. But it is, I think, an unequal kind of structure. It's not as widespread now. In fact, in almost all homes that I have visited now currently, all the women eat together with the men and with the whole families. But it is true that there will be somebody to serve because in India, somebody has to serve the food. And usually women tend to do the serving of the food, because men are not doing the housework and they are not cooking.
They wouldn't typically prepare the food, but they would serve it.
So it is like it's seen to be a function of the woman of the house to serve to her family members. But it's not as widespread now. You know, now what happens mostly is that the food is served on the table and then everybody eats together. But it is true that it's still there in some parts. I've seen it in Bengal and I've seen it in some parts, not in Delhi and not in other parts.
As you were growing up and going through the educational system in India, who were some of the heroes that you had or heroines or whatever from Indian history, people that you kind of look to as models or inspiration?
There was, in Indian history, Rani Jhansi was considered to be a great model. She was a queen in India, in central India, and she kind of rebelled against the British, and she was a very powerful kind of queen. And so she's considered to be a model in Indian context. You know, Indira Gandhi is considered to be a great model because she was, of course, India's, you know, woman prime minister, and she ruled for a very long time. She was a very strong woman. Sarojini Naidu, a woman who acted in the national movement. So there were lots of women in the national movement who were models and considered to be important.
And the national movement had what for its thrust?
To remove the British, the national movement, which kind of started around 1885 or so. And the Indian National Congress was formed at that time. And then its aim was to overthrow the British. And when Gandhi came around 1915 or so, it became a popular movement. And that time, lots of women, in fact, Gandhi, in fact, said that, you know, women should be part. And in fact, he said women are mothers. And so it had both the impact of mobilizing women, but it also typecast women as mothers. And therefore, they have to serve and, you know, take care of everybody. But they are a very important part of the Indian nation. So both of those things happened at that time. So there were lots of very, very crucial figures. In fact, Nehru's daughter, Indira Gandhi, played a role in the national movement. And then, of course, she went on to become India's prime minister in 1966.
Was it primarily a non-violent movement after Gandhi? And was it more violent before Gandhi took... Older the national movement?
No, it was in before Gandhi came or became, you know, the dominant leader or tried to reorganize the national movement. It actually was an extremely small elite movement led by lawyers and professionals. It had a small violent component, but that just had started and it was not very extensive. Yeah, but after he became part of the movement, it does become, or he makes nonviolence to be one of its standing principles and important principles. But the overall, the national movement does have a component which is actually what they call revolutionary terrorists. But that was not part of the Indian National Congress. But their main aim was to kill Britishers. But they also had a strong ideological basis because they suggested that they want to, you know, reform Indian soul and civilization, and also Britain is a very violent kind of intervention into India. But it is true that the mainstream or the popular part of the national movement essentially espouses nonviolent techniques. In fact, Gandhi stopped a campaign in its tracks because somebody threw a bomb at a police station. And then he stopped the full movement, which was, you know, at that time in 1922. So nonviolence does become a very crucial element of the movement. But the real crucial aspect is actually the fact that it becomes very popular. So almost everybody, even, you know, it becomes what is like common people, poor people begin to participate. Till then, it had been very elite.
And what prompted the British to agree? Did they set that date, 1947, some years in advance under some certain circumstances, or how did independence come about?
Independence came about, they did not set the exact date, but around 1940 or so, 40, 42 or so, actually 42, Britain had started to talk about giving India dominant status, which is kind of some kind of independence, but they were not discussing dates or anything. I think the independence came about because the Indian National Congress, led by Gandhi and, of course, a whole host of other leaders, because it's a very dense, and it's interesting about the Indian National Congress that it had provincial elements. So each province in India had a wing of the Indian National Congress. So it had regional leaders, and all of them used to have simultaneous campaigns. And so from about 1919 onwards, there were regular campaigns against the British, which were nonviolent mass movements. First was a non-cooperation campaign, then there were progressively other campaigns. The most famous one here is the Salt Satyagraha in 1930, when Gandhi kind of said that he will make salt, and he used that to mobilize the whole country. And 1942, there is something called a Quit India movement. And Quit India movement is essentially, it's at the time, of course, of the Second World War. And at that time, the Indian National Congress gave a call that Indians will not support British war effort. And so there were kind of some talks at that time happening about whether India should become independent or have some autonomy. And I think the real crucial element was the defeat, in Britain of the Conservative Party. So once the Labour Party comes into power, as soon as the Labour Party comes to power after the Second World War, then they declare that we will declare India to be independent. But after 1920 onwards, there have been regular campaigns, civil disobedience movement, almost on a, you know, monthly or yearly basis. And the pace of rebellion and civil disobedience is kind of slowly going up. So Britain had no choice. But I think if the Labour movement or Labour Party had not come to power in Britain, it would have taken longer.
We're going to talk about relations between India and America today when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
We're always interested in hearing what you think about our programming. Please write to us with your comments at Audience Services, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison 53706.
In a country like India, you are basically never alone. The idea of solitude is a luxury which only rich people enjoy. That's a quotation from Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Asima Sinha, and we're talking about India. The novel Midnight's Children is set, having to do with Independence Day in India, 1947. As we move beyond that, can you give us some sense of the economics, the split between rich and poor, and... Mm-hmm. what efforts are underway now to combat the poverty you mentioned earlier on? Mm-hmm.
India till recently was, of course, poor, but also grew very slowly, which meant that growth was shared in a very unequal manner, but also there was very little to go around, as it were. What has happened is that India has started to grow very rapidly since 1991. Inequalities have persisted, and to some extent they have increased, although partly because growth has risen, there is more to go around. So lots of winners and new groups of people have also started to enjoy prosperity, which did not have access to those wealth-creating opportunities before. So it's a story in which inequalities persist, especially rural-urban inequalities persist. Income inequalities have also, you know, do persist, but inequalities have always been in India. Now, in terms of poverty, interestingly, India poverty actually has declined, although urban poverty has become a little worse. So in the last 10 to 15 years, India and China, in fact, in both cases, relative poverty has declined. But yet, in terms of absolute numbers, there are actually a lot of poor people. So, for example, around 300 to 350 million people earn less than $1 a day in India. And if you actually calculate or look at $2 a day, which is very less, about 800 million people earn less than $2 a day. Yet, the middle class and, of course, other sections of society have managed to acquire benefits of the increasing growth. So, for example, the service sector industries, which also includes low technology service sector like tourism or health structure or education infrastructure, people associate with that. Or people in the garment industry who are beginning to export a lot, small-scale workers are also beginning to get the benefits of the globalization boom. So inequalities persist, but as I said, it's now a sharing of prosperity to some extent amongst unequal communities.
Does India have the same concern that China has with population growth? Or do they want to be number one?
Well, I don't think they want to be number one, although they want right now, they talk a lot about their 1 billion population. But the problem is that in India, partly because of its democracy and because an earlier campaign to use force to control population, that agenda of controlling population is just not there on the political radar screen of most political parties.
So it has this taint, in other words.
So no political force can say that we will control population. So they do it through education and even, you know, very subtle campaigns. So no systematic campaign to control population has been used in India ever since 1970s.
You mentioned technology jobs, and I've heard many American comedians make jokes about the outsourcing of jobs, that if you call for help with your computer, someone in India is going to answer the phone. Can you say something about that, the sense that most Americans have now that many of the jobs from mm-hmm. American companies are actually being handled by workers in India?
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, it is true. And what is interesting is that more than just jobs being handled by Indians in India, there are lots of Indians in United States who are doing a lot of, they're working for IBM and they're working for all the software companies, and as well as they're working for lots of other high technology company. In that sense, they're actually contributing to the economic growth within and the brain power of the U.S. in producing innovative products and services. The other aspect to this is that actually some Indian companies now, which are beginning to set roots in the United States, and they are employing Americans. So, for example, Tata, which is a big company, a very big conglomerate, it has multiple companies, around 16 different companies. It has hired about 5,000 local people in the U.S., and it is trying to set roots here. There are other companies that ran Baxi, which is a pharmaceutical company, which also has had offices and manufacturing units in the U.S. So the outsourcing issue has different layers. One layer is people in India answering phone calls. And there are also call centers, by the way, in the U.S. which employ Americans and then for American clients. But there are lots of call centers, yes, in India too. So there is an outsourcing in that sense. It's an issue. You know, it's interesting that Indians have to come to the U.S. to become innovative. And so they're brain power, in a sense, is, you know, being used in the American context, which contributes to productivity here and contributes to the kind of value added which America provides, continues to provide.
And when you read newspapers from India, which I know you mentioned earlier that you do, when you read newspapers from India, what kind of attitudes do you see projected about Americans? How is American mm-hmm. political systems and news playing out there?
the common Indian people generally, I think, in fact, from all sections of society, even the rural areas, and I'll say something more about that, but most people actually are very pro-American. They consume American culture and they would love to be in the U.S. There was a recent survey done by a research think tank which showed that about 29% of India's youth would like to, you know, actually be citizens of another country, and that's it, that country is the U.S. So, and that's a very high figure. So American culture is extremely popular, and American educational institutions and universities are very popular. So everybody would like to come to the U.S. to study. But there is some antipathy to the United States among some political classes who feel that America can be a dominant power. In fact, currently there is a lot of debate in India about whether India should become closer to the U.S. in its foreign policies. But my, you know, research shows that actually even in smaller towns and rural areas, I mean, rural areas which are at the outskirts of towns, there is a lot of popular support for the U.S. But some of the political classes, especially actually the left political parties, don't want a closed foreign policy with the United States.
It's complicated, isn't it, by the war on terror, during which
yes.
the United States pulled closer to Pakistan, which is a traditional rival and sometimes enemy of India?
Yes. In fact, that has come up in the debate currently, with the left parties making the claim that the United States is unpopular in the whole of the world. And why should India, you know, think of it as a close ally? And it is actually, this is a germane partly because India, of course, has the third largest population of Muslims in the world. So the Indian government, for example, there was an issue whether India should send troops to Iraq as part of the war, the U.S. war on terror. And in fact, the BJP government at that time seriously considered it, which is quite interesting. But they actually rejected the idea because of its 150 or 160 million Muslims. They didn't want to alienate. So it has political implications whether India should be close to the U.S. But I think that there is no doubt that India will become close to the U.S. First of all, U.S. policy itself has changed dramatically. But being global integration has actually changed India in the sense that there are many Indian companies, general people, middle class, which always have very strong links with the United States. All of them want closer interaction with the West and specifically the United States. So while it has had traditional close ties with Britain, given the fact that Britain colonized India, now there is no doubt that most people would prefer to be closer to the United States.
When you look at Indian democracy, which is the largest democracy in the world, yeah. What features about it would you say Americans might learn from? In other words, if we're comparing our democratic system here or our lack thereof to what happens in India.
I think that one of the most striking features is that we spoke earlier about untouchables and Dalits and poor people in India. They vote in much larger numbers than the educated classes and the upper classes. This is one of the most striking reversals in comparative history, which is that in most countries, educated people actually vote in larger numbers than the poor and the disadvantaged. In India, it is the reverse is true. So the Dalits and untouchables actually vote around close to 55 to 60% voter turnout in most elections. In the elections in the last
spectacular.
Yeah, in the last to the last 15 years, actually earlier it was much worse. So since starting from 1985 or so, the trend has reversed. So it's an interesting kind of example of how political apathy does not strike the poor and the disadvantaged. And that aspect of democracy is, I think, quite interesting, which is different from the West. I guess the other thing is that, yes, that I think Indian democracy has managed to leash very strident fundamentalism, although there is violence in India. And in fact, just a few days back in Hyderabad, there were, you know, blasts. So violence kind of happens all the time, but the violence doesn't destabilize the country. And some of the extreme fundamentalist forces are, I think, controlled or shaped by the Indian democratic system, because many of them themselves want to fight elections. So, for example, again, in Kashmir, which has been a hotspot and seen to be a source of problems for the world, as it were, currently there is a locally elected government in power, which has meant that, and some of the so-called terrorists or so-called people who were inciting violence have now come to the election and they fight elections. The Maoists in India in some parts use violence and in some other parts they actually fight elections.
Fight elections, you mean they contest elections?
Yes, contest, yes. Yes, they contest elections, yes. That's what I meant. Yeah.
So it continues to get complicated.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's a very large and very complex country, as we've seen, India, and it'll be fascinating to see how it continues to emerge, you know, on the world stage as countries rise and fall around the world. Our guest has been Asima Sinha. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
A pleasure having you with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.